This is a HeadGum Original.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hi. For those of you who are listening to this podcast, Dead Eyes, for the first time, welcome. Before we get started, a bit of advice. This is our 31st episode. If you have time, it might be more satisfying for you as a listening experience if you go back and check out a few of our earlier installments. My recommendation, episodes 1, 3, and 6. My producers suggest episodes 2, 10, 13, 20, and 27. Tom Hanks and I have yet to appear in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but this episode is sort of like our Avengers Endgame, the big event it's all been building towards. That's actually a callback to one of our episodes in Season 2, but it's also the last time I'm going to pause to explain when something from a previous chapter is referenced or resolved. And now, here's the episode.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. What a special moment for a special boy.
It makes me really anxious.
Anxious for this part, talking about it, or anxious for the possibility of what's happening next?
God,
you have terrible Wi-Fi. You have terrible Wi-Fi.
This is me talking with my friend Ben Schwartz, actor, improviser, Jean Ralphio on Parks and Recreation, the voice of Sonic the Hedgehog, seen most recently on The After Party. I got in touch with him a few minutes after I received a surprising email.
Yeah, but I... Mm-hmm. I mean, I got to figure out how I respond to this email, which...
You haven't even responded yet.
No, I haven't responded. I don't know what to do.
No, you're doing great. Respond anytime you want. It's an email.
It's an email, so...
What do you want to write back?
This is what the email said. Connor, not sure how to volunteer my services to you, but joining you on your podcast would be a pleasure. Tom. And then below that it says, T. Hanks. So... At first, I wasn't sure if it was real or a prank. The address was unfamiliar, and honestly, anyone could have written this. Longtime listeners will recall, I have been fooled before. I will not be fooled again. I sent a screenshot to my producers, Mike and Harry, who immediately began investigating to confirm that it was a legitimate email from Tom Hanks.
Then I got a FaceTime call from Amir Blumenfeld. He was in his car. He was so excited he had to FaceTime me from in the car. He goes... I just need you to, all I need you to do is confirm one thing. Tom Hanks' email. I was like, I'm not going to give you Tom Hanks' email. He goes, I just need to know if this is him. Connor got an email from this person. We all think it's fake. We just need to know if it's him. And then he read the email and I go, holy shit, the kid did it. It's like, oh my God, Connor did it. The idea that he's heard about this and isn't averse to coming on must be a fantastic feeling. And I can't wait to see what stupid shit you talk about before you ask him about the Dead Eyes. It's such a I can't wait. I just can't wait to see. It's the Super Bowl of Dead Eyes. It's the Super Bowl of Dead Eyes.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
I don't remember everything about the whole experience. The other thing is, you know, I was 24 and clean-shaven. He's going to be meeting this, you know, 46-year-old hobbit person now.
So bring your headshot. Connor, you got to bring your headshot and show it there so he'll... Do you have your headshot from that exact time?
I have one from close to it, yeah.
Great. You got to bring it. You got to bring it. Bring props. Be Carrot Top for this episode.
I emailed Tom back. I said yes, enthusiastically, and right away, he and I were messaging back and forth, coordinating a time and place when we could meet and talk, together in person. Mike and I bought plane tickets to Los Angeles, where Tom's based, and conveniently where Harry works. His boss, Adam McKay, who has appeared briefly on this podcast, was more than happy to loan out his studio for us to record our long-awaited conversation. The morning of the interview, we showed up a couple of hours ahead of when Tom was scheduled to arrive. We all took COVID tests, per studio protocol. We set up the recording gear. We waited. I was in the studio when he entered the building. And the weirdest thing happened. I felt like I was suddenly back outside the re-audition room at Hatfield 22 years ago. The familiar sound of Tom Hanks's voice, no discernible words, just the distant melody of it, accompanied by the hushed but excited murmuring of studio employees ushering him down the hallway.
He's here. I can hear his voice.
I can hear it too.
You okay?
Yeah. When do I take my mask off?
Harry and Mike sat in the control room on the other side of a big glass window to the studio. And for about 30 seconds, I didn't know what to do with myself. I was just standing in the middle of a room waiting for Tom Hanks. And then he appeared.
Hello.
Hey, I'm Tom.
Hi there.
Connor.
Connor? How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You are?
I am, yeah.
This is
another thing that brought back memories of my re-audition. Purely by coincidence, the furniture in the studio, couch, chair, low coffee table, was arranged in the exact same configuration as the last room Tom and I had been in together back in 2000.
Yeah. So where would you like me?
Well, you can sit here if you want, but you can sit there if you like.
But I'll sit over there.
Okay, great.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's absolutely fine.
Great.
Yeah, I'm going to move a couple things.
Back then, Tom sat on the couch. This time he chose the chair.
Well, this couldn't be more comfortable. Jeez, we're just sitting around a living room having a conversation.
It's just a human moment. That's all
great.
It is.
That's great.
Okay, here we go. From this point on, I'm going to sit back and let this conversation unfold without my usual interruptions and editorializing. Well, I couldn't be more pleased to be having this conversation.
Well, do you want to trip me or hug me? Do you want to punch me or kiss me?
What's COVID appropriate? Is hugging and kissing allowed at this point?
Well,
you know?
I brought in my vaccination card.
Great,
If that's where it ends up, I'll be totally.
No, I think this is going to be a really pleasant conversation. That's always been my goal from the beginning of doing this podcast. And I guess the thing I want to start out with is finding out how you heard about this podcast.
I heard about it from my son Colin and my daughter Elizabeth.
And what was your first thought when you heard what the concept was?
I was aghast. I actually got chilled. My heart rate, you know,
yeah,
skyrocketed, and it said, I did what? I did what?
Now, I guess I'm going to skirt right to the basic, the heart of the matter.
I think we should.
Which is the central mystery of it has always been that I had an experience and I never could figure out, I could never fully unpack where in the process something broke down.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got the message that I got, which was, you need to go re-audition in person for Tom Hanks. He's seen your audition tape. He's having second thoughts. He thinks you have dead eyes.
Wow.
And so I had the train ride down. Where I just kept thinking, what do I do? What's the trick? How do I pop the eyes as I'm delivering these two or three lines?
See, my heart is racing right now hearing this story.
Now, this is the first opportunity that I've had to ask it. Like, maybe a more confident 24-year-old would have asked in the room, like, is there something different I can do? Or
yeah,
did you?
Yeah. What happened when you came down and read in person?
I waited in the little room.
This was a casting place in like Soho.
This was at the Airbase. This was at the Airbase at Hatfield.
Oh, really? I was out there for that?
Yeah.
Did I have a huge beard?
It was post shaving the beard.
Oh,
you
know, okay.
But you had a little stubble. You had sort of like Michael Stipe.
This was for the this was for the episode that I directed.
This was for episode 5. I don't think I knew about Castaway when I met you. And so one of the jarring experiences was you were wearing like a sort of like a sweatpants and like a casual clothes, but they were just hanging off.
Yeah, I was very skinny.
All I knew was my initial sighting of you was, oh, no, Tom Hanks is sick. Like, so I was processing this.
Well, that's why I asked if I had the beard, because there's one period where I was losing the weight and had a, you know, an 8-inch long beard, and, you know, I looked like an insane man. But that was probably 8 months before we started shooting.
So I got there and I waited in the office, and everyone was very nice, but it felt like I was sort of like the problem in the room, sort of, that was like, oh, this is a little bit uncomfortable.
Oh, my Lord.
And I had been down at Hatfield to get my hair cut and get the costume fitting like a week or two earlier.
I swear, if I have to bolt, I'm going to upchuck in the bathroom for my part in this.
And then I heard you. It was very similar to what just happened, where I heard you enter the building.
Okay, yeah.
And
big presence.
Yeah. I could hear a voice that musically I recognized as that is the, I couldn't hear any words, but I could hear the music of the voice of Tom Hanks. It was very,
that's me.
And I could hear people were, you know, sort of chattering. And then I came into the room, shook hands and said hello. And then he said, well, let's hear it. And
I actually did this.
Yeah.
I said that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And so we did the scene. So there's not like Zelinsky doesn't say a lot.
What was the scene? I can't.
The scene is, the scene is.
I wrote this episode too, so I should know this.
It's when Nixon comes to visit Winters, and Winters now has an orderly, and Zelinsky was the orderly.
Okay.
And Nixon sort of is razzing him a little for like, you've got an orderly. Oh, maybe you go get us a couple of bacon sandwiches. And he sends him off to go and get a couple of bacon sandwiches. So this
is vague memories of it now.
Yes. So this is, the character is basically just there as a signifier his new status and how it kind of makes him uncomfortable.
Yes, Winters was made the XO of the, which turned him into a guy who typed a lot of reports and was no longer fighting on the front. And along with that, he got an adjutant, an aide in his office in order to do things like get bacon sandwiches.
Right? Yeah. So we read the scene and you said, is that it? Oh, I wish there were more. And then I went out of the room.
Uh-huh.
And then Suzanne came out a few minutes later and and I remember she sort of sat, she knelt down where I was and she said, they've decided to go another way. And then,
this is a bone chilling story. It's just bone chilling.
I remember walking around London and I'm thinking, I'll go to the record store. That'll cheer me up.
I'll always buy something after you get bad news as an actor, yes.
The Green Mile had just been released in London.
Oh,
so there was
Lord.
A giant poster.
Oh.
And I remember thinking, if I'd been fired from a Wendy's, I wouldn't see the guy who fired me on a poster afterwards. You know, it's one of those things. Because I was already so nervous about meeting you in a positive context that suddenly now I was thinking, well, now, what am I now? Like, it sort of felt like I had built this thing up so big, and then it was just gone. So, I put it to you.
You can see, if you podcast listeners could see my face now, I'd be such a grimace.
People have always said, when I've been doing this podcast, what if he doesn't remember? I said, that's fine, because he was actually busy recreating World War II at the time. It was a pretty big job. And this was one thing. Very big to me, but I'm sure 5 minutes after you recast the part, you were on to the next thing and then the next thing and then the next thing. Does any of this ring a bell with
you? Not a single moment of this rings a bell. Now, let me first take full responsibility for doing this to you. This was without a doubt the act of the director.
Yes.
And that was me. There was something that either stuck in a craw or was one of those very, very subtle sort of decisions that aims the story in the direction that you want it to go. You are not a coffee cup, but sometimes they come to you and say, would you like the blue coffee cups or the red coffee cups? And you say, I'll have the blue. And then when you get on the set, you find out, oh, you know, the color is the red. I'll bring in the red coffee cups. The prop guy says, well, we ordered the blue. So it's going to take a while for us to go dig out the red coffee cups. And I said, well, you got 20 minutes, you know, so do what you can. Otherwise, lose the coffee cups. You know, it's like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is, look, I have to admit that I am not an instinctive director. I'm an instinctive other things.
Yeah.
But the directors that I know of that I've worked with have no problem making thousands of decisions every day.
Yeah.
And they usually make the right decisions. I just barely scrape by and hope out of, I hope I make 50.6 correct decisions out of the course of the day.
Yeah.
Now, for some reason, in the midst of the fury and exhaustion of directing anything, first of all, I should have said, I don't know, let's take another look at this guy. Someone should have said, and by the way, I'm not saying this was all on me. Don't think for a minute that someone else got in here. But I will tell you a story because I've been thinking about this moment sitting here with you.
Yeah.
If someone said, well, he's already been cast, then I would have said, oh, well, it's a bunt. No problem then. Somewhere in the course of that, a director will get a bug about something. And I don't know why I had a bug about the guy who was playing Zelensky, other than trying to make sure that, one, he looked like he was a paratrooper, because all those guys were, you know, they all jumped out of planes, even if they were just typing. And two, who knows what else goes on in there. All right. But let's imagine I actually watched the tape and said to somebody, I don't know, man, this guy's got dead eyes. I said that. Dead eyes.
Does that feel like something you'd say?
Yeah, because it's been said about everybody. I mean, it's been said about me. He's got a big ass. You know, this is the story. I'll go back in time. When the first movie that I made with Penny Marshall was in 1987 or something, and I thought I was a big shot. And so I thought being a big shot on a movie entitled me to access to the inner sanctum of watching the rushes. I'm the actor in the movie. I work every day. Therefore, I am entitled. It goes along with all along the food chain that I get to go and sit and watch the rushes. I get to watch the dailies. So after we shot, after the first day, I showed up in the screening room in Midtown Manhattan. I sat down there because I'm big. I've got status here, man. And so I am going to watch the rushes that we shot yesterday. Yeah. I had seen the screen tests. I had seen the wardrobe tests. So I thought I would be watching the daily rushes. And Penny made a beeline to me in the theater and said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here to the rushes. You can't be here, she says. You can't be here. You don't get to watch dailies. I said, I think I do. Because I am, you know, I have this stature and status now that everyone must obey. And she said, no, you don't. You don't get to see dailies because in this room, we have to talk uncensored. We are going to say terrible things about you and the lighting and the props and the dolly moves and you. That line is not the line that said, that is a horrible thing. I hate this take. I'm not using. His hair looks stupid. Why does he have those folds in his neck? Why is his voice so squeaky? We have to say all these things. And if you're here to hear them, it's really going to screw you up. Now, what I learned from that exchange, which took me a while, was that the worst thing an actor could do is watch the dailies. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't like to watch the playback on the monitor because it just becomes one big exercise in self-consciousness. That's what I look like. That's what I sound like. That's what this scene is like. This is a disaster. So I stopped doing it. On big. I never watched dailies again and never tried to. Even said, well, can I at least watch VHS cassettes to see what the lighting is like? Even that was all a waste of time. So in the inner sanctum of whatever this casting session was on Band of Brothers with me and the crack staff, I'm sure I said, I don't know, man, that guy's got dead eyes. I could have said he's got too blonde a hair.
Right.
I could have said, he's too tall, and I can't have the aide be taller than Captain Winters. I could have said, he's too short and slight. He doesn't look like a pair. I could have said any of these things.
Yeah.
And they would have been true, and they would have been the opinion. And if someone had also said to me, well, he's already cast, I would have said, well, can we replace him? I would have said that. And yeah. I've done it, and I think it's been said about me on occasion as well. All right. So with that, whoever communicated to you what was said in the inner sanctum,
yes,
with such authenticity, should have their kneecaps broken because that is not allowed. The inner sanctum is like it's like the dugout, man. It's not quotable there. It's off the record.
Right.
I could have said his face is too red. And if someone comes back to you and says, your face is too red to be in this show, that's what the man in charge says. So what you should have been told was, they wouldn't have said you have to re-audition. They said,
yeah.
You should come down and meet Tom. You should have been told that.
Yeah.
Not that there was any sort of test that was involved.
Yeah. And I knew even on that day that there had clearly been some breakdown in communication, because I knew enough to know that unless it was an especially cruel mind game, there'd be no reason for that. That message had made it through multiple levels of, even when it got to my agent's office and it was the assistant who called me.
Yes.
I've talked to him. He has no memory of delivering the message, but he also, when he was talking to me, it felt like there may be a part of him that remembers it, but not, you know what I mean?
Your agency should never have been told, Tom thinks your client has dead eyes.
Yes. And that person should have then looked at that message and said, let's not tell Connor this.
Exactly.
But I think the panic of the last minute, you have to come, you do this.
I get that.
I think that was probably a factor in it. Now I found this. I don't know if this will help.
Oh, that's my headshot.
Because I have...
These are not dead eyes. Can I just say that right now from this 8x10 black and white?
Absolutely.
I don't get it. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What was your physical state? Were you a slight guy back then? How tall are you?
5'10".
Okay, 5'10". Were you skinny?
I was skinnier than I am now.
Well, okay, we all were. Were you slight? Were you out of shape? Were you in good shape?
I would say I was in what I would say normal human shape.
Okay, all right,
not
all right.
Impressive shape, right. But also not, no one would be concerned.
I'm trying to go back, and honestly, I have no recollection, but I have very few recollections of any day in the course of directing that, because it's just such utter chaos.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to figure out what possible rationale I had for making a change in a role that only shot for one day. I'm flummoxed as to why I even bothered saying, let's go in a different direction there. I don't get it. My bad.
When I watched the scene, I don't imagine, this scene would be better with me in it. Band of Brothers won the Emmy for casting. It's hard to be bitter when you know that the thing that you're disappointed about actually happened exactly the way it should have in terms of the work. I look at the scene when it aired, finally. The first thing that I noticed was there was a height disparity in the shots where Adam Sims, the actor who plays the role of Private Zelinsky, is significantly shorter than the other actors in the scene.
Okay, that might have been a reason.
And visually, it's not like a gag.
Right.
But it is a little immediate, you know, within a second, this is my orderly.
Yeah, there's a cinematic a visual there that probably I was going for.
Well, I mean, even though you have no recollection of the actual
thing. None whatsoever.
But you're also not under oath.
In the very vagaries of directing something, a moment of insanity like that happens really, really, really quite often. And I'm sorry that you were the butt of it.
I'll tell you, I had a thing in my mind, and I was thinking about it that day, which was I had just written and produced like a very small indie feature for myself to act in, because I was trying to do everything I could to sort of get things started. A friend of mine directed it, and we had filmed this movie in Missouri, and we had hired Holmes Osborne to be in the movie.
Yeah, so he's a legendary actor of Missouri, Kansas City area. Yeah.
And we drove to Kansas City and we filmed it in like the basement of the director's house. Holmes came over and he said, yeah, okay. And he kind of sat down.
One of the greatest actors in the world, Holmes Osborne Jr., yes.
And we had such a blast because we would do takes, then we would let him go. And he was playing this creepy mentor who was like a recluse. And that was a few months before getting cast in Band of Brothers and then having the re-audition. Mm-hmm. I was thinking when I found out you were going to be directing it, if I ever have to make small talk, I can mention that I've worked with Holmes.
My Lord, if you had said that in the re-audition, that would have been that. You would have been in, there's no way I would have said, thanks for coming in, we're going in a different way. Never would have done that.
It was on the tip of my tongue the entire time.
Missed opportunities.
I was worried that I thought, is this too desperate a Hail Mary pass if I say, Holmes Osborne says hello? Now, because I'm going to fill you in on another part of the story that I learned, because since you don't know any of this story.
I don't know any of this story.
This part.
Even though I'm responsible for the whole damn thing.
You know, that often happens in a lot of Shakespeare, where there's a character who starts it off who doesn't know everything that's going on. When I talked to Adam Sims, the actor who plays Zelinsky, he'd auditioned a couple times. He said he'd played a lot of stuff where it was just like a soldier who like groans or something. And he got the call to come, that it was going to be coming to read for you in person. And we realized that it was the same day. And what we realized was that there were, this was maybe the most excited I've been in the whole process of this podcast, because I felt like a real journalist. I remember saying to someone, can you imagine if this was actually an important story? Mm. Like this would be a real Woodward and Bernstein moment where we're figuring out what happened. I was in a car with Suzanne Smith. And there was a second car with casting director Gary Davey and three possible Zelinsky replacements.
Oh, man.
They were taken to Hatfield. I was taken to Hatfield. Suzanne was very nice to me the whole day. She really took care of me in terms of like making sure that I was comfortable, making sure that she was very kind and warm all day. But they were taken to a room to wait, and I was taken to the office to wait. And I was so grateful in hindsight that this whatever had gone wrong.
You were just stuck in a room and they were all looking at each other.
Yeah. Whatever went wrong with the dead eyes comment and communication went right with the make sure the three alternate Zelinskys are kept in a separate place.
Well, in that case, I tip of my hat to the casting people because they did that right.
That would have been the true nightmare, would be when you're in a room and you realize that guy looks a little like me and that guy looks, oh no.
Yeah.
These are the...
We've all been there. Well, yeah. I've been sitting in a room with seven other goofy-looking guys with squeaky voices, yes.
But my guess is that...
Does he have any memories of shooting the day that were unique?
Adam's experience was really positive. He, you know, he auditioned that day. He actually, his telling of it, I found great significance in this, was he's waiting in the room with the other actors. And he said, the other actors were kind of like talking a lot, and he was sort of staying quiet. And I said, that's smart. He's sort of like not trying too hard. He said he got up there. He's waiting in the room. He asks, where's the bathroom? And he goes to take a leak. And you came into the bathroom and took a leak next to him in the bathroom. And I said, tell me you didn't make a joke or anything. He said, nope. We just said, hi, hey. And he left the room and then went into audition a few minutes later. When he came to the audition, you said, hey, I just saw you in the bathroom. And I said, you know, because I've sat in as a reader on auditions, and there is that thing where someone walks in the room and they have the part before they sit, the second they walk through the door. I've seen that happen. And I said to Adam, I think your audition was not in the room. I think your audition was in the bathroom at the urinal.
So,
when you didn't try to make a joke. You didn't try to impress anyone.
So here's the turn.
Yeah.
One guy did not say something at the urinal.
Yeah.
And it's possible that was the turn.
Yeah.
You did not mention Holmes Osborne in the room.
Yeah.
And didn't get the job. So there's another cruel twist of fate. Two guys did not do something. One had a pot. One was 00. The other one was 01.
It's one of those. It's a Wonderful Life moment where it's you start thinking about what you did or didn't
don't
do.
Don't pull those threads, man. It's a delicate knit, the whole thing that got us from there to here.
Okay, I know I promised I would sit back and shut up until the end, but we have to do commercials. You know that, right? I mean, we did two whole episodes this season about how commercials are just part of being an actor. Maybe you heard those episodes, maybe you didn't. Anyway, we got to do an ad break here. Dead Eyes will be right back.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
When I think back to now having the answer that if I dropped Holmes's name and I'd made that little bit of chit-chat, that would have turned it. I do, as I have thought back to this, I had a couple of other sort of things I was trying. You know, the film that I'd done with Holmes got into a film festival.
For Holmes Osborne played Guy Patterson Sr. in that thing you do.
Yeah.
He was also in From the Earth to the Moon, and he was also in Larry Crown. So I've worked with Holmes every time I can.
And he's delightful to work with.
Lovely man.
And he's electric on screen.
He is. And he's in Wind Talkers.
Affliction,
which he is brilliant in. Which is, I mean, look, I think he's a crazy, odd kind of genius. I knew him in 1997, 78, and 79. We did Shakespeare together in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
He was Valentine, I was Proteus, and the Two Gentlemen of Verona. So we've been cohorts. He always said, well, Tom, now let me tell you now, I've got a few more years in the biz than you do. That's the way we refer to it. Years in the biz. I've been in the biz a little bit longer than you have.
Yeah.
And he is, he's worth his weight in gold.
And he's a great storyteller as well. Just in conversation, we had him on the podcast and the conversation was almost 2 hours because he had so many stories.
He's like that. Had you said, oh, hey, I worked with a buddy of yours, Holmes Osborne.
Yeah.
It would have been Katie barred the door. You would have played Zelensky and we wouldn't be sitting here talking right now.
We absolutely would not. I said this when I talked to Eric Jenderson and we had this great conversation. And I said, if I'd booked that part and filmed the scene, I never, ever would have been able to have this conversation because everybody has a disappointing experience who tries to go into show business. This one has a number of elements in it that make it distinct. Like, if it had been any other director of any other episode, it wouldn't have felt the same because I wouldn't have had an invest. Like, I went into this experience having a certain sense of excitement and anticipation that I was going to be working with one of my favorite actors. So it meant something Boing. To feel like I, you know, in the broad strokes of it, to feel like I was so defective as a human being that even the nicest man in show business could not work with me.
Oh, dear.
Whereas if it was just any director, but I was probably at some point, if I'd done Band of Brothers, been in the scene, I think in the final version, he has like one, maybe two lines.
Yeah.
I would have then been back to square one as an actor.
Yeah, you know, but you would have been invited to the reunions that we have the reunions.
True. I'm not saying it wouldn't have been great. It would have been great. But I was going to face a big disappointment at some point down the line. If I just keep trying to be an actor, you're going to face these.
Well, you have touched on something that is the great inequity and the great X factor when it comes down to this. And I learned this beginning in 19 years in the biz, Tom, years in the biz, is that there is luck. And it's blind, and you have no idea. And by the way, good luck, hard luck. I mean, there are people who sign on for a job for $75 a week, and then they get offered a TV series, and they can't do it. You know, that happens all the time. But there is also the requirement of perseverance, and I think that actually is the breaker. There are people that cannot take the 5, 6, 7 years. They can't take the long string of disappointments. They can't get past coming close and not getting it. They mm-hmm. can't get past getting fired. I think it really does cull the herd very, very quickly.
Right.
Because there are versions of a career that are not based on getting on TV. I know a lot of people that Holmes and I knew back when we were at Great Lakes Shakespeare all have careers, and many of them have careers in theater because they still do films locally. They teach in universities. They've been in the educational theater for a long time.
Yeah.
When I auditioned for things, when I was not getting them, I always treated myself to something. A cheap ballpoint pen, a new notebook, a candy bar that eventually gave me type 2 diabetes. I did something so that I could come away from the day with something other than disappointment. Now, what you should have done, I guess, is gone out and bought a car in order to treat yourself to the disappointment of me saying you had dead eyes. I'll tell you a brief story. I've been fired. Or I've been informed that what seemed to be like a sure thing, I had frittered away. Literally, like, what happened to you? Your first audition was great. Your second audition was fine. You disappeared on that third audition, man. I can't hire you now. I said, oh. I've also had moments where I was going to be cast in a movie. The main people involved that said, you are in this movie. And then I never heard from them again. Except wow. until I saw the movie and it had somebody else in it. That happened twice.
Yeah.
Then there was one other time where I was going to do a film and I had had a meeting with the guy who was the writer and the director, the movie and everything shall remain nameless. And I called him up out of the blue because it had been about 3 or 4 months since we had talked last. And I just called him up and say, hey, I just thought I'd check in. You know, I've read the script a bunch of times. If you want to talk, I'm available. I said, yeah, sure, let's talk. And for about 20 minutes, we talked this, we talked that, we said this, we said that. And the next day, I got a call from my representatives that said, what happened on that phone call? And I said, it was a nice phone call. We talked about possibilities on the screenplay and what we could do when we shoot this thing 6 months from now. And they just said, you're off the picture. So that was that.
Wow.
That was that. Now that... Those all were long before I had spent the money, you know.
Right.
For you to have won the role and then said, oh, no, you have to go down and audition for the director. And then for me as the director to say, hey, thanks for coming in. And then somebody to kneel down and said they're going with you a different direction. That's a level of cruelty in what is a cruel business that is almost off the scale. That's like getting fired from the scene as you're shooting it. Which is bad.
Yeah.
That would be bad.
Basically, when I made that movie that Holmes had a little part in, and it got into a film festival, got in the Austin Film Festival for October.
What's the name of this film?
Living in Missouri was the name of the movie.
Okay, all right. Note it, internet listeners.
I don't think you can find it on the internet.
It must be. It's got to be on YouTube somewhere. Go deep in the bowels of the dark net.
We got into a film festival. We got accepted in August of 2001 for October of 2001.
Ah, I know what happened between
yes.
then and then.
Yeah. And there was a series of things like that where I started feeling like, well, like the first episode of Band of Brothers aired
yes.
on the Sunday night before.
Yes.
And I couldn't have felt sorrier for myself as I was watching. And I was thinking, this is, how am I going to make it through the next 2 months? Right, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to anybody. And 2 days later, I realized, oh, actually, no, it's a very small thing that I went through. I'm not upset.
Yeah,
it was sort of,
yeah.
it was a...
It's a great refocusing moment, yeah.
Yeah, it was a real, the camera pulls wide and you realize like, oh, right, I maybe have been making too much of this.
We are but grains of sand scattered amongst along the beach, along the shore.
Yeah.
You know, movie making comes down to the most arcane, nonsensical moments where for some reason... You open a can of dog food in a real fascinating manner. And all you did on the day was open a can of dog food. And yeah. you might have did. And then when people see the movie, they said, man, that scene where you open that can of dog food, I've watched that a million times. You go, okay. That's the great serendipity of all of a sudden. I would say in like for that, in an example of that episode of Band of Brothers, which was episode 5. It's called Crossroads. It's right in the middle of the series. You've got 4.5 episodes until the middle of that episode, and then you have 4.5 episodes afterwards. It is called Crossroads for a real reason. There were moments in there I said, I thought, this is the most key moment in the entire series because it's the last time Captain Winters kills an enemy soldier. And he looks like he's a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah.
That was it. Now, whether or not that has resonance or not, you can only go into it and say, this is what I'm, you know, this is what I'm aiming for this to be a moment that breaks the rest of the series. And you try to do that again and again and again. And whether it works or not, God, it's not up to you. It's some other powerful force.
I can tell you from my own point of view that it works because the night that I watched that episode, I remember thinking like, oh, that's good. it was in that fog of post 9/11, everything
we did not know if we were going to be back on the air after 9/11.
Yeah.
We didn't know if this was going to be a jingoistic, you know, a shock and awe kind of like bit of quasi propaganda, or if it was going to be a tonic for a nation that was looking for some sort of common purpose in the midst of the most insane thing that had happened in our lives.
I remember for me that it was something to do on Sunday night that would I could focus on in a period where it was sort of hard to focus on things. You know,
there's a power to that. There's a power to that concept of that brand of appointment viewing. Mm-hmm. Game of Thrones has done that. Mad Men did it. The Sopranos does it. It's a brand of old school anticipation that you're sort of not used to, but I happen to adore it.
When I thought of the idea of doing this podcast, I was always concerned that it would be something that, like when you described having chills when you first like heard about it, I really didn't want this to be something that would annoy you. As I was thinking about it, I remember I was talking to my manager saying, is this a bad idea if I do a podcast about this? Like, because I thought maybe it is really stupid to do, like, from a purely careerist show business point of view, to be like, I don't want people thinking this is a takedown podcast or that I'm looking to get revenge or something. I've seen people write about the podcast where they say he's looking for revenge. Like, I'm not looking for revenge. I'm a nice guy looking for a nice conversation. One of the things that gave me the feeling that it would be okay was I had a realization about two of the movies you've written and directed. Larry Crown is about a guy who gets fired. And for the first act of that movie, he feels terrible. He's moping around. And the whole movie is about what do you do when you have a disappointment that you have no control over and you got to figure out how to reframe your life. Then I realized that thing you do, Shades, his ending at the end of that movie, in the extended cut of that movie, he basically starts a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
It's the 1964 version. Yeah. He has those tapes of the interview.
Interviewed Del Paxton and
you can't get closer to a 1964 version of a podcast than jazz interviews on a jazz radio station. Yeah. And I thought, well, these are the themes that the podcast is about. It's about trying to figure out, you look at a moment where things don't go your way, and everybody has something like that. Mine happens to star a 2-time Academy Award winner. Beloved.
Long ago, by the way. I was done by the time you and I met, but yeah.
I was rooting for you for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
But you know what? You're talking about something. When I heard about this from my son and from my daughter, the initial chill was, oh, what have I done? Because, look, I've told stories on the air and I've made mention of things that ended up like hurting people that were involved. To me, they're just life stories.
Right.
But it's like I could be bringing up a painful episode in them. And I feel terrible about that. And I'm getting better at doing it perhaps the right way. But this is a dispassionate look at history. Meaning that there's no bad guys here. There's this happened, there's that happened. It's not like you offended me, and so therefore I sought retribution by not giving you this job. In lesser hands, the melodramatic aspect would just be, well, there must be a reason
Right.
That Hanks fired this guy. And there actually was no reason. It was just like, I don't know. Let's go with somebody else. So the dispassionate aspect of that, I think, is very, very important. Because when we have narratives, we break it up into I was a victim of blank or I triumphed over bad guys. And that's not the way the world works. And forgive me, but when I first started talking with Bill Broyles and then eventually Bob Zemeckis about Castaway. And even it's a theme that comes back again and again because I'm absolutely fascinated by it. Bill Broyles and I was talking. He says, well, what is the point of this? What do you want to say on this movie? I said, here's what we do. We'd start the movie in a beautiful setting, a beautiful farmhouse with a gorgeous tree. There's a lovely lady on the porch. And I've got three gorgeous kids that are goofing around on the grass. Everybody's happy. Everybody is laughing. And I could say that this fabulous life of mine would never have occurred if I wasn't in a plane crash that isolated me on an island for 4 years.
Yeah.
That, to me, is the great aspect of Shakespearean drama and every great novel that I've ever read, that you don't have this magnificent story without some form of tragedy happening to you. And that speaks to perseverance, of keeping going despite any number of bad news. It speaks to the serendipity of, you know, you never know what's going to come down the pike. And it takes the melodrama out and gives you instead a dispassion. They say, well, this happened and then this happened. And that's where, you know, I ended up today. I mean, Larry, I was a man possessed in writing and directing Larry Crown. But it always comes down to is like, well, what's the worst thing that happened to you? I got fired from my job, in this case, Larry Crown from Unimart. And I said, and what's the best thing that happened to you? Well, actually getting fired from this job, because then I went to school and all this amazing stuff happened. And that's my experience. That's my autobiography in a single page.
Like, I was never able to get away from it as an experience because of the, you know, green. The second I saw that Green Mile poster on the side of in Piccadilly Circus.
That's almost too good.
I thought, oh, no, I can't fully move on from this. I have to assimilate it because I'm not going to stop hearing things about Tom Hanks seeing things about Tom Hanks. So I knew that it's like, well, it became a joke. When I started getting to know people, in the first episode of this, I talked to my friend Darcy Carden, who was one of my first friends at UCB. I said, I've told you this story before. She said, you told it to me on the day that I met you. And it's become...
Yeah, you might have been carrying that around in your pocket then.
It's, well, whenever someone's like, so how'd you get into this? How'd you get started?
Mm-hmm.
It was the thing that would always explain, like, well, I tried to be an actor once, then I took a break. And it was also the funniest and most interesting part of that process.
It's a good story. What happened to you after that? What was your next job after me letting you go because of your dead eyes?
For a little while, I was a dishwasher at one point.
All right, I've done that.
I worked at my friend's preschool for a little bit.
Didn't do that, but that's a survival job.
And then I worked at Barnes & Noble Union Square for 13 years.
Wow. All right. The book business.
And I loved it. And then I started taking classes at UCB at one point in New York.
Okay, all right. Upright Citizens Brigade, one of probably the premier improv institutions in the world now, yes.
Yeah. And eventually, I kind of fell backwards into show business again. But what I found when I looked back on the experience was that it had built a lot of character in terms of when I returned to show business, I knew not to take everything so personally. Mm. I knew that for everything that can go right, it can also go wrong just as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the story became a very funny story. And there's, if you remove one detail from the story, it no longer works.
Right.
It has to be you.
Right.
I've tried thinking of it. What if it was somebody
else?
And
that's the dispassionate aspect of it, which I think is fascinating and makes it a million times more interesting to discover.
If I were to just get a message that they've decided to go another way and then I never hear anything else, that's not a great story.
No, yeah.
I have to be told he thinks you have dead eyes, because then it creates this larger emotional...
All right, so let's look at the stepping stones here. If that inner sanctum had been protected, meaning if someone said, well, we will never tell this, you would have got a call that would have been said, hey, this is great, but they decided to go a different way, and that would have been that. So if the protocol had been followed, you would not have had as fascinating a story.
I would have had nothing. I would have just...
Wow.
I would have been... I mean, I would have been fine. It's not like... I think things still would have worked out eventually, but... It's been such a gift because we never would have arrived at this place if I hadn't had my little show business nightmare.
Mm.
It's been a real lesson in terms of even a negative experience can sometimes be the thing that is ultimately more rewarding than if I just had a lovely time filming for a day on Band of Brothers.
Well, isn't that the serendipity that that you must have faith in? There is a type of seasoning of who knows what's going to happen, a pure unadulterated chance that moves stuff along somehow.
Yeah.
And it never stops happening in a career. It happens when you have no job. It happens before you have a union card in your pocket.
Yeah.
And it continues right along until, they drum you out of the business.
How do you process disappointment when something doesn't go your way?
Oh, my Lord. It's by going into it with absolutely no expectations whatsoever. That's hard. Because, look, I was spoiled because, the first movie I made was a hit. The second movie I made was a hit. And I thought, well, the magic sauce in any movie, obviously, is my presence.
Right.
And then when you make literally five movies in a row after that, in which are not just dismissed, but sometimes loathed by people, and you read it, you learn pretty quick is that movies are binary. They're either double zeros or zero and one. There is no other version of what it is. It either works or it does not work. The nature of marketing and prints and advertising, so there was, before the advent of cell phones, quite frankly, you could be in a really terrible movie on Friday, and no one would know that it was really terrible until Monday, if they didn't read the reviews, if they weren't up on it.
Right.
Because on Monday, people went to school, people went to work, and they said, I saw the worst movie on Friday. Now, as soon as cell phones became ubiquitous, in the first nanoseconds of a film, someone is saying, hey, this is great, or hey, this sucks.
Yeah.
So that's just one of the great, shifts in the cultural zeitgeist that goes along with it. So going into any movie, you have to, any story that you're trying to tell, every step of the way, is this a good thing? I don't know. Did it work? I don't know. Were dailies any good? Who knows?
Yeah.
Is it going to cut together? Maybe. Bob Zemeckis, when the first time we worked together, we had two moments. One, we were, sitting in a park bench in Savannah, Georgia. And I said, Bob, is any of this going to work? I mean, is anybody going to care about this? And he said, it's a minefield, Tom. It's just a minefield. They're out there. Are we going to step on them and blow our legs up? Don't know. We'll find out. Then when he was cutting the movie together, and he that was a very particular kind of union between the guy in the movie and the guy who was making the movie. He said, I can't do this without you being my soulmate. I can't make this movie called this and have the guy who's playing the title role not be a part of everything. So I want you to look at this and tell me anything. And when he says, I don't have any ego about this, I did not believe it to begin with. But then I found out, truly, he doesn't have any ego. I said, here it is. Dispassionate. I don't want to overuse that word.
Yeah.
But when we were doing it, I said, I don't know. I saw a cut of it, and I said, hey, but I don't know. I'm the last person you should ask about it. He says, well, the good thing is the movie will tell us what it is. And that is true. And if it doesn't work, man, it don't work. So to answer your question, you can't go into it with any expectations whatsoever. All you can do is try to be fascinated by the work that you're doing. That's it.
Okay, sorry. Got to do one more ad break. I promise this will be quick, and then back with more Tom Hanks right through to the end of the episode. Dead Eyes will be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
When we started at the beginning of this podcast, I was like, well, the dream goal is to eventually get to talk to you. I didn't know whether that would take years, whether it would take minutes. Like, there was part of me that thought when we released the first episode that there'd be a phone call right away saying, we got to shut this down. He's going to talk to you and we want to put an end to this.
Cease and desist order.
Yeah.
In a registered letter in the mail.
Or I was fully ready to like, well, it'll take as long as it takes and maybe it'll never happen. The other holy grail, it's more terrifying than, like, I'm not nervous talking to you. I'm very relaxed. It just feels like a normal conversation. But the other thing that does make me nervous, and it probably doesn't exist, is my original audition tape.
Oh.
I don't know if this is in a shoebox somewhere. I don't know if it's in a closet.
That's a good question.
Or a cupboard. But I fear it in a way because in some ways, whatever you might have seen on that tape, that I will look at that and think, oh, God, I can't believe I even made it through the audition process.
I predict that if it does exist, you would have looked at it and you would have said, what's wrong with that? You know, you said, geez, I wish it would have had more. Here, one of the things that I don't know is because those auditions happened in England,
yeah.
It's a completely different system that we have here. We were still using essentially camcorders, you know, small VHS, maybe Sony 8mm in order to, which you can't find anymore.
Yeah.
So I wonder what media all of those auditions are on and if they've been kept.
Yeah.
I bet they haven't.
I would bet they haven't. I didn't know. I bet the most important stuff is somewhere HBO Playtone archive somewhere.
Unless the director himself on his home, Ron Howard.
Well, that's you in this case.
Well, I don't have it because it wasn't my home home video. Ron Howard did auditions on his JVC VHS compact disc tape for Splash, and he actually still has those, and I've actually seen them, and it's painful. It's really painful.
I think it would be painful for me to see mine. I was talking to somebody about this podcast, and they were saying, you're finding all these connections with people. And I'm like, well, once you start looking for them, they're everywhere. And the fact that I already knew Holmes before I walked into that room with you, and I was too chicken because I thought maybe if I say it, it'll be enough. Maybe I'm so close to not getting fired, but I thought, what if I say it and it's annoying? And
you know, there is a thing that has happened, I think, because we can now self-tape so perfectly on iPads, that serendipity is removed. The do I or don't I? Do we talk about this or not? So you can save it for later on.
Yeah.
You could save it for that moment where you really are, you've bypassed. I'm meeting you now for a really good reason because I want this to work out. I've been on both sides of the audition process. I've walked into a room hoping that I was a guy they wanted and left out being no thank you.
Yeah.
And I've also sat on the other side of the desk praying for the perfect Zelensky to walk through the door. And when it happens, it's undeniable. And when it doesn't happen,
yeah,
it is still left up to some sort of like odd chance, because it might just be that at the end of the day, you go with whoever you're closest to, because you can't nail it any other way.
Yeah.
It's brutal. It's as cruel as baseball, I think. You know, it's you should win, but you lose. You should lose, but you win. And it's that inexplicable and requires, if I can go back and overuse this word again, a degree of dispassion. I don't understand people who are pissed off because, he didn't give me that job, or, you know, she cut the scene that I was in, or something like there's no room for that. There's no room for that in the, you know, it's a journey of many steps. And the only thing you can do is keep stepping, keep walking. That's the perseverance that's required.
It's been an interesting thing to process, because I learned the lesson a while ago, that thing of you have to move on to the next thing. When something doesn't work out, the most important thing is just, well, what can we learn from this? And is sometimes nothing. Sometimes you have a bad experience and it's just a bad experience.
Just a bad experience.
But is there anything that you can get from this?
When I found out about this from my daughter and my son, I literally said, how bad is it? That was my question. And he said, no. They both said, no, it's actually a really wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy is really taking this thing and has nothing but a great perspective. And at the same time, you know, an authentic version of what happened. And because you were told, I thought you had dead eyes. That's about as concrete a statement as anybody is ever going to have from anybody.
Yeah.
But I go right to the cheesy melodramatic narrative, which is like, oh, okay, so this is going to be essentially an ongoing poison pen letter. But it's not, because the people in the know, the people who live on Fountain Avenue, as I like to say, know that there's no room for that. You can't go there. If you do, it's the death of moving forward.
If you imagine yourself in your early 20s, who would have been the person that you would have most not wanted to be fired by?
That's like a triple negative in there.
Yes. Is there someone who was like, who you adored as that? Like, who was the big actor or movie star that you would have taken as the ultimate sign of negative?
You mean this would have had to be after I was in town and I was beginning to audition for things.
Yeah, let's say this is like 79-ish, 78, 79-ish maybe.
Well, I remember that both Peter Scolari and I, in between the seasons, we only made two seasons of Bosom Buddies. And we thought, hey, we got a little cachet here.
Yeah.
Let's get out there. And not a peep, not a dent. There were, you know, at that time, there were all kinds of things that were casting all the time.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, I'm on this show.
Yeah,
I got something, you know. I wasn't, you know, it was a certain thing. And nothing translated, absolutely nothing translated. Yeah. Whatever we did on the show, the most that you could get out of it was like because we were on ABC, you could do The Love Boat or Fantasy Island or,
right,
you know, Circus of the Stars.
Yeah, Battle of the Network Stars,
you could do that. And I didn't do any.
When are they bringing that back?
Oh, soon, I hope. Don't you? Don't you? Along with American Gladiators.
All the streamers can fight each other.
Yeah, wouldn't that be something? Ted Lasso could take on, a Squid Game and...
I think that's a... If that doesn't get the clicks, I don't know what will.
But, you know, you're talking about another thing, too, which is like, I was palpably sensing that, okay, I have given up. I have thrown in. I'm all in on this TV experience of Bosom Buddies. All of my efforts and all of my cachet and anything that comes after that is going to be due to what we're doing here.
Yeah.
And it was a nightmare. I mean, I think I went to bed more petrified every night than if it hadn't been for the friendship of Peter Scolari and, you know, the kind of like molecular bonding that we had in that thing. I think it would have gone nuts.
From the outside, looking back in hindsight, I would have looked at that and I would have assumed, well, once you had Bosom Buddies, you had it made.
Oh, dear Lord, like, no. Oh, heck no.
As a kid, I definitely would have looked at that and said, He's the star of a sitcom, and from then on, it's smooth sailing.
Well, I was unemployed for the year after that. You know, I remember I signed a deal with CBS that did absolutely nothing, so I got no series after that.
A year can go quick, but a year when you're waiting for something that could happen any day.
Well, this is the great, this is the fantastic thing about now, is that because we can make our own movies with our phones and our iPads, and because there is a huge talent pool. Like, everybody says, if I'm coming to L.A., what's the first thing I should do? I said, the first thing you should do is make a bunch of movies where you are right now. You got friends. Find somebody to write something shooting on your iPhone. Do it. And put that up. Get it up on YouTube as soon as possible and do that. And if you're going to come to L.A., the next thing you have to do is figure out your posse, get your crew, go to the UCB. By the way, UCB is, honestly, you should get the Nobel Prize or the Pulitzer or something like that for the amount of comedic talent. But not just comedic talent. Storytelling chops have come out of that place. So when I was here in 78, 79, there was no place to go outside of an acting class or maybe some small theater that no one would come and see in Los Angeles in order to do it. So you had to like throw down, I'm going to be a New York actor and try to work in theater there, or I'm going to be in L.A. And I ended up in L.A. and I couldn't afford to go anywhere else.
Yeah.
I was trying to make, pay the rent and take care of the family and make my car payments.
When you have had to, I mean, in this case, you were making a call. You weren't having to fire someone directly. Have you had to ever fire someone directly to their face? Because that was another thing. On the day, part of me felt like I wondered whether I would have felt better or worse if you had come out of the room and been like, hey, listen, this won't work out, but don't worry. You know, like part of me imagined on the drive back, I'm like, I wonder whether that would have made me feel.
I was responsible for somebody being fired.
Right.
I was not the day-to-day guy. I won't. This is very, very tough. You guys get together because everybody involved is, you know.
Right.
Has an awful lot of stuff going. But I asked, are there any bumps on the road?
Right.
You know, all the decisions have been made. It was going forward. And there was a certain amount of time left that if any changes have to be made, we have to make, you know, got to make them right now.
Yeah.
And I asked, are there any bumps on the road? And everybody at the table all looked at each other. And I said, what? You know. And the word came back that there was somebody that didn't seem to have the kind of like philosophy, just they were kind of like the weren't quite the drummer we needed in the band.
Right.
And I said, well, then they have to go.
Yeah.
And they said, do we have your permission to do that? And I said, well, do you have somebody that can come in and play the drums? This is not about
that thing you do.
No.
You're using code.
I'm using code. Is there somebody that can drive the bus, you know?
Right.
And they said, actually, there's somebody else that we would love to be able to put in this part and drive the bus. And I said, do it. We have your permission. So there was another time when the dailies on the very first thing came in. And I had to say, oh, no, this can't be. And it was a purely, it was a purely physical thing. I said, we just can't have somebody that is like this. And they said, at that point I had to call the studio and say, look, I've never done this before, but we have to make a change. And they said, well, you know, okay, do you have a solution for this? And I said, yes, I do have a solution for it. And that worked out.
Yeah.
It's bone cracking. On one hand, it's the last thing you want to do, but it's the first thing you have to get done.
Yeah.
And it's not pleasant. Because look, I've been in that. I've been in that position and I've also seen other people being put in that position too.
Yeah.
And did it crack up somebody's, you know, immediate life? Yeah. But did it also solve a major flaw in the porcelain? And the answer to that question, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Movies are, I find that you have to start a movie on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
Because by Friday, everybody has proven their value. And if they're causing more problems, and that this goes for, you know, number one on the call sheet or number three on the call sheet as well.
Yeah.
If that, man, it ain't happening there, then guess what? You change things on Saturday and you bring somebody else in and show them around on Sunday, and they show up to work on Monday morning. It's just the way it happens.
Do you have something that's like a Deadeyes story that from your own experience, like when you were younger or something? Something that you've carried around that you think like you've either made peace with it or for a while it bugged you?
Well, learning what I have over the course of time, that you can't put too much on this and you can't let it fester and you have to write it off as we are all but leaves on the river and, you know, and we make our way to the sea. Now, this is going to sound really, really, really kind of, oh, come on. Are you really that much of a goody two-shoes that you recall this? When I went to 2 years of junior college, mm-hmm. during which time I only allowed myself to take one theater class per quarter because I thought I was just going to, what do? You go to college and you get a degree in something. I don't know. Who knows? I didn't think you could actually study theater. I didn't think that was a job that you could pursue. But when I was going to junior college, I saw examples of it. I said, oh, no, actually, you can study this like you can study drafting or electrical engineering or, you know, pre-law. It's like, oh, there is actually a course of study for the theater. And I have seen enough of this life to realize that if I could get a paycheck in a theater, that would be about the greatest job in the world. Stage manager, assistant stage manager, lighting designer, sound. I'll do anything. Actor, that'd be great. So when I started, I went to a state university in Sacramento, and lo and behold, the very first play I tried out for, I got in. And it went to the American College Theater Festival. It wasn't a big part at all, but I was
my freshman year of college, drama major, I had a play that also went to the American College
the
Theater
ACDS,
Festival.
Yeah, big thing. You go to, if you make it through the regionals, which for us were in Fresno, and if you get chosen, you get to go and perform it at Washington, D.C.
We didn't make it past regionals.
No, we didn't make it past regionals either. We died in Fresno, as the case may be. I don't know what I want to, but.
I think mine was Kansas City. We died in Kansas
City. Okay, all right. You know who once won the Irene Ryan Acting Award for literally best performance at the American College Theater Festival? You know who won it?
Who?
Don Johnson.
Really?
Don Miami Vice Johnson.
Wow.
I had dinner with him at one point. I said, Don, I got to ask you a question, man. You won the Irene Ryan, by the way, is Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies. She was an incredibly accomplished actress, and she started up this fund to give away the Irene Ryan Award to the best college performer, best college actor at the American College Theater. Oh, this side stories.
Yeah.
So I was in this production, and the next audition was for this really great comedy that I want, you know, I was in college and I was taking the classes, so I auditioned for it. All of my friends, every single one of them, who I had just acted with in this other play, mm-hmm. were cast in this play, except me. I lost it out to a guy who was incredibly good looking and gorgeous and blonde and looked like a superhero.
Yeah.
And he was a friend of mine. And when I didn't get that part for the better part of 10 days, I thought, well, that's that. I'm done. I can study. I can stage manage. I can do this. But if I can't get cast in that, what... What am I going to do? I know what was coming down the pike, and there was nothing. And I remember taking the taking the bus home from campus. I was sharing an apartment with two law students who were going to a law school in town, two guys that I knew from Oakland. And I was bummed out. It was just like I have experienced a type of negativity that I had never in high school. I always got cast. In junior college, when I finally tried out for a play, I was cast. So I had never not made it into the cast. And when it happened, I thought, this is the great divide. This is the door closing. Everybody else is on the other side of the river and I'm left here. And then I heard that there was a theater downtown that was auditioning for something. And I went downtown and got cast in a production that happened to be directed by a guy who was running the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival. And he invited me and four other people to come back and work in his theater. So, again, what's the best thing that happened to me was not getting cast at school so that I could go down. And that, an example of that is the thing that happens again and again and again and again. Just as the pleasure of the excitement of being cast in the high school play, we auditioned Wednesday, Thursdays, and Fridays, and we had to wait for Monday to find out if we were in the show or not. 12th night, Night of the Iguana, South Pacific, My Fair Lady, things like that. And on Monday, it's like, oh my God, we made it. I made it. Oh, this is the most exciting thing in the world. Along the antithesis of that was I didn't get cast in the show with the thing. And I thought, well, that's all over. That's all she wrote.
And if you pull at that string, if you had gotten cast in that play, you might not end up at Great Lakes.
Yeah. I wouldn't have been available.
Yeah. And who knows? From that point on, like, your whole life could have been different.
Well, that's the way it works, and you know, it's a cuckoo thing. If I hadn't just gone to Sacramento, you know, if I hadn't gone to Chabot Junior College, who knows what if, you know, you never know. The road not taken.
At another point in my life, if I'd found out in 2003 that if you'd only mentioned Holmes Osborne, you would have got it. Yeah. It would have really bugged me.
Yeah.
But now, if I were to pull at that thread, magically I say, hey, I just worked with your buddy, Holmes Osborne. It would undo everything that I've had, including this conversation, experience.
Yes, yeah.
It would, and this is, I mean, you and I would have exchanged a handful of words that day.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't remember it.
Wouldn't remember a thing.
Because as soon as you got the scene, you're on to the next thing. We got to do this. I wouldn't have made an impression. Whereas I feel like there's a reasonable chance you'll remember this conversation.
This conversation I'll be talking about at dinner parties for the next year and a half and continuing along with it, without a doubt.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking to me.
This has been great.
I'll ask you, and you don't have to promise this. I won't hold you to it, but I'll put it out there. Next time you're directing something, let me read for
it.
Okay. I'd love to read for
it. I guarantee.
No expectations. I'm just another.
My crack staff behind on the other side of the double pane glass will keep that
keep
promise.
Keep me on file.
I will.
That's
indeed.
All I ask. Just
I'm trying to think of what we have that's going to be coming up cooking here pretty
I'm willing
soon.
To shave for it.
Okay.
Great. Yeah.
I really enjoyed this. Thanks
I've
very much.
I've had so much fun talking to you. It's been cathartic and pleasant and wonderful.
Who else is on your wish list now for this?
Nobody. I don't know. Who else?
When our conversation was over, I had two things for Tom to sign. One was my copy of the full shooting script for Band of Brothers Episode 5.
You kept this.
I put it in a filing cabinet and I forgot about it.
You have the famous thing that said, this is what's known as a one-liner.
Yeah.
That tells you every day scene of that day and how long you're working.
Yeah.
And the here it is, Band of Brothers Part 5, The Crossroads by Eric Jenderson, based on the book by Stephen Andros. Current revisions by yours truly. Wow. Yeah.
He wrote on it to Connor, what eyes you have. And it just now occurred to me that he is paraphrasing Little Red Riding Hood, and that I once played the role of the wolf in a 1997 production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods at drama school in Liverpool. And that thought is making me realize that I no longer need to search for patterns and connections like that. It's going to be a hard habit to break. The other thing I had brought for him to sign was one of my two DVD copies of Tom Hanks's Electric City that I had bought back when we were putting together our Electric City episode. When I placed it on the table, it was clear from his reaction that he had never seen one of these before.
Is this yours?
That's mine. That is Electric City.
Now, my God.
On DVD.
Yes.
Do you have this on DVD?
No, I don't.
You know what? I'm going to give this to you because I found this on eBay.
We worked so hard and long on that thing.
If we
take this and try to do it for real, you'll come in and you'll play the guy
keep that copy.
You'll play the guy that Cleveland Carr kills at the top of it. How about that? Yeah. Thank you. Hey, I'm going to watch this at Wire Central. Holy cow.
Yeah, and it's subtitled, but you can think you turn the subtitles off and it's in English. So.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh,
great. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What a pleasure. What a treat. My Lord. What a great pleasure. Thank you.
After the mics were turned off, we left the studio and went out into the common area of the office. It's this cavernous, refurbished warehouse with a huge, backlit, shelf-lined wall, packed with art books and historical nonfiction. Tom was immediately drawn to the selection, standing in front of it.
We posed there for photos, making small talk while the cameras went off. And at one point, when we were standing there almost eye to eye, he looked at me as if he was trying to figure something out. His arms were folded, like a director considering a camera angle. And he said, "You know, it was probably the height thing." I told him that was my dad's theory.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 22 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. I made a podcast about it, and he agreed to be a guest. When it was over, he said he would keep me in mind if he was ever casting anything I might be right for. And that's the short version. Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. Our producers are Harry Nelson and Mike Comite, and our associate producer is Jordan Allen. Special thanks to my guest, Tom Hanks. And thanks to my friend Ben Schwartz. In addition to verifying for us that it really was an email from Tom Hanks, Ben is also one of the reasons this podcast is what it is. There was a point when it looked like I was going to have to record this thing on my phone because nobody was interested in it. And right when we needed a champion, Ben vouched for it personally with Jake and Amir, and it became a HeadGum original podcast. So thank you, Ben. Also thanks to Amy Mann for writing and recording the song Dead Eyes specifically for this episode. The track was produced by Paul Bryan and features Adam Tressler and Jay Belarus. I'd also like to give some additional thanks to people who have helped make all of this possible, including Claire Slaughter, Whitney Tancred, and the fine folks at Hyperobject Industries. Also thanks to Earwolf, who allowed me to make the original pilot for Dead Eyes. And you know what else? Thanks to BB Newirth for being the voice you hear at the beginning of every episode. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you're friends with Steven Spielberg, whom I'd really love to talk with to see if he remembers his awkward interactions with actor David Krumholtz when we return with season 4 of Dead Eyes, The Krumholtz Conundrum.
Fuck you.
Or maybe not. We'll see what happens next. Thank you so much for listening. Be smart. Stay safe.
was a HeadGum Original.